We don't do too many series here, but occasionally we'll take several lessons to do the same subject. Last Sunday, we began a study on the patriarchs, the heads of the tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, whose descendants became 12 tribes, the Jewish people. And we sort of set the stage, did sort of an introduction, talk about the 12 sons in general and how they became a great nation by going down to Egypt. And we're going to start talking about these 12 sons. Back a few years ago, we did a study of the 12 apostles. And of course, some of those apostles we know a lot about, some of them we know very little about, other than, I mean, the scriptures haven't revealed a lot. There, we talked about a little bit of tradition carefully. But we're going to spend more time on some of these fellows than others. But we're going to talk about the 12. And the reason it's important, I believe, is because we are spiritual Israel today. And we need to understand what temporal Israel, what the physical Israel, what the type is to the antitype. And the better we understand these men and their families and the children of Israel in general, the better off we're going to be. Those things that were written before were written for our learning, and we need to learn what we can from what's been revealed to us. We're going to see men and women who were not perfect by a long shot, and we, you know, we already saw a little bit of that last week. When we start looking at these men specifically in their lives, they made some real mistakes, and yet God was able to use them nonetheless in order to carry out His will. And we've seen already, and we're going to continue to see, that the character of the father doesn't necessarily correlate with the character of his descendants, the tribe that followed him, and there seem to be some disparities at times, and that's okay. We'll see how that worked out in the lives of these men. And then we're going to emphasize the fact that God judges men individually. Each one of us are going to stand before God in judgment. But I will tell you, men commit sins that have dire consequences in the lives of those around them, their families, their friends, society at large. And we bear the brunt of the consequences that sin, of the sins that men commit. But we're going to be judged as individuals. We'll certainly see that as we go through this study. We agreed last week that we're going to look at these men in maybe a couple of different ways. We're going to look at the men themselves and the lives they lived and some of the high points and low points. And then we're going to take a little bit of time and look at their descendants and the character and the nature of the tribe that followed them. We looked at the 12 sons quickly last week. And we notice that depending on what text you go to, they may be listed in order of when they were born, oldest to youngest. Other places like Genesis 46, they're grouped by mother. And so we had Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, who were sons of Leah. And then she gave her handmaid to her husband Zilpah, her handmaid. And she had Gad and Asher. Rachel was given two sons, Joseph and Benjamin, and her handmaid Bilhah had Dan and Naphtali. So that's the 12. And again, they didn't have them in that order, but that was the 12 sons. We agree that we're probably going to come back to this little diagram from time to time. It is one artist rendition of what the campsite of the Israelites might have looked like. There were three tribes who would camp on the east and the south and the west and the north. And God prescribed all of that. And sometimes it has some significance. And of course, the Levites were camping in the middle with the tabernacle. There's some significance to all that. And we'll come back to that. We'll also take a very brief look at where they ended up settling when they made it to the promised land that God had given them in the land of Canaan. And at times there's some significance to that as well. Well, we're going to start out with Reuben, and we need to get right into it. Usually when I do a lesson like this, somebody will meet me at the back door and say, you know, I get most of your sermons, but you lost me on some of that. We're going to try to stay clear, and we're going to try to hit the high spots. But there's going to be some information in here because it's about people's lives. And there's certainly not going to be a quiz at the end. But I think we can learn some things about the mistakes these men made, the good things they did, as well as their descendants. And I think we can learn some lessons from them. Reuben, we noted last week, meant something. The names of all of the sons meant something, and the mothers assigned names to them depending on what was going on in their lives at the time. And Reuben meant, behold, a son. And because he was the firstborn, and particularly Leah, the least favored wife of Jacob, saw that as a sign that she could be the first to give her husband a son. And so she named him Behold a Son. She said, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. And so there were a lot of sad things about a polygamous relationship like that, and some very good reasons not to duplicate those today. But she felt blessed to have the first son. Now, we look at Reuben's personal character. It's a bit of a mixed bag. And he was forever defined by his father, and I think by God, by the immorality that he committed. And that's unfortunate. It's a lesson for us, but it's unfortunate. You recall Jacob had met his two wives and married them and had 11 of his sons before he left Laban's home up in Padan Aram. And then they begin to travel south to go back to reunite with his father Isaac. But on the way, about the time they got to Bethlehem, Rachel was pregnant with her second child, and she went into labor and had her child, and she died as a result of complications from the childbirth. But she lived long enough to see the boy, named him Son of My Sorrow. Her husband changed his name to Son of My Right Hand. That was Benjamin. But just shortly after that, we're told that Reuben committed fornication with Bilhah. Bilhah was the handmaid of Rachel and the concubine of his father Jacob. And as bad as immorality is, it's not only immoral, it has devastating effects in families. And that was certainly the case here. And Jacob knew about it, and he never got over it. And you know, you have to stop and think that six of these fellows were full brothers, but the other six were their half brothers by other mothers. And this Bilhah that he committed fornication with was the mother of his two younger half-brothers, Dan and Naphtali. I mean, this can't be good for any family. And it was not only immoral, it was poor judgment on his part, indiscretion on his part. And those kind of things cause untold pain and suffering and agony for any family. And as I say, his father never forgot about it. As he's pronouncing his blessings and cursings on his son before his death, he remembers this toward the end. You can't talk about these 12 sons. We're going to mention this probably 11 times because, you know, all of the sons of Joseph were envious of their brother. They were jealous of him. And it wasn't all their fault. Jacob brought a lot of that himself by the favoritism, the blatant favoritism that he showed to his son Joseph. And certainly Reuben shared. And this was not a casual jealousy. This was envy and hatred. They wanted to kill him. That's how badly they hated their brother Joseph because of the partiality of their father. And certainly Reuben shared in that. But we have to give credit where credit is due. And when all this issue unfolded surrounding Joseph and the way his brothers treated him, we have to give Reuben credit for being the voice of reason. You recall, Joseph's brothers were out tending flocks. Joseph went to check on them, find out how things were going. And as they saw him coming from afar off, they all hated him so bad they begin to plot, what can we do? Maybe this is a golden opportunity to kill the guy, this young man that we hate so badly. But Reuben, the oldest son, the oldest brother, persuaded them to do him no harm. But he said, here's a pit over here. Put him in the pit instead of killing him. And Genesis 37 verse 22 tells us that he had a plan in mind. He intended to go back later and rescue Joseph out of that pit and to restore him to his father. That was his game plan. Now, apparently Reuben is somewhere else at the time, and the other brothers decide that when this group of traveling Midianite merchants are coming by, they'll just sell Joseph to them as a slave. They'll get some money out of it, and that'll take care of their problems. It'll get rid of Joseph, and they do that. They pull him up out of the pit, take his coat, they send him away with these Midianite merchants. When Reuben goes back and looks in the pit, it's empty. And you can imagine the fear in his heart. What has happened to this boy I was going to rescue and take back to his father? When he talks to his brothers, he finds out what they've done. And it's too late. The deed is done. The boy is gone. And so he is complicit in this conspiracy. They come up with a plan. They tear his coat and they put blood on it, and then they give it to Jacob, and they allow him, they encourage him to jump to the conclusion that Joseph has been torn by wild animals and is dead. And so he was part of that, but he was the voice of reason. Had they listened to him, the whole issue would not have happened. Joseph would have been back to his father Jacob, safe and sound. But Reuben shared in the lifelong guilty conscience that all of these men shared. And it was all of their lives. They never got over it. You recall years later, there's a famine. Joseph is down. He's a high official in Egypt by the providence of God. And now these boys are sent by their father down to Egypt because that's the only place grain is. They don't want to starve to death. So they go down there to buy grain, and they are reunited with Joseph. They don't know who it is. All they know is this arrogant Egyptian official who's making unreasonable demands on them, accusing them of thievery and spying and all kinds of things. You know, for a little while, Joseph made their life difficult. But when they thought they were in real trouble, Reuben said, and over in Genesis 42, verse 22, Reuben said, "Did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood. God is paying us back for what we did all those years ago to Joseph." And he didn't... Truth be known, he didn't really do anything wrong, and we were wrong in what we did. Now God's paying us back. They never got over it. Finally, when Jacob died, they almost went into hiding again. They were afraid maybe Joseph was just waiting for Jacob to die so they'd come back and take his retribution then. They never got over their guilty conscience for what they had done. But to his credit, he stepped up when times were tough. With this Egyptian ruler, who turned out to be Joseph, demanded that they bring Benjamin, the youngest son, back to Egypt so he could see him. Well, of course, Jacob didn't want to send him. He'd already lost one son of his beloved Rachel that he had lost, and now they want to take the other son, put him at risk. But Reuben committed to protect the boy, said, you leave it up to me. I am committed. I will bring him back to you safe and sound. And by the way, here's the life of my two sons, and if I allow anything to happen to Benjamin, you can put my two sons to death. Times were tough, and he was willing as the oldest son to step up and to take responsibility and do what he could to try to deal with the difficult situation. Now that's the character of Reuben. And again, it's a mixed bag, but I'll tell you know, one horrible mistake in your life can have some dire consequences. When, as they often did, the father of the family of those days, when they were elderly, they knew they didn't have long on the earth, they would gather their sons together and pronounce blessings and in some cases cursings on them, depending on the circumstances. And in the case of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it was not off the top of their head. It was prophetic. God spoke through these men. And there were pronouncements that Jacob made about Judah and others that they would never have known on their own, other than God telling them that that's the pronouncement that needs to be made for this particular man. When he got to Reuben, Jacob said, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power." And that sounds real good right after that point. But then he says, "Uncontrolled as water." You get the idea of, you know, try to get a drink, and before you can get a drink, it's running through your fingers. "Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." That's Genesis 49, verses 3 and 4. As the oldest son, he should have had the birthright. He should have gotten a double portion of his father's inheritance. He should have had the preeminence in the family. Now that dad's gone, they look to the oldest brother to be the patriarch of that branch of the family. But instead, Joseph is the one that got the double portion. Instead, Jacob was the son that became the preeminent leader among his people. Over in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, it makes that clear if you look at the first two verses. In 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2 of Reuben, it says, "He was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. Though Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came the leader, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph." And so it acknowledges both of those. This double portion, this double birthright, this inheritance that should have gone to the oldest son went to Joseph instead and his sons. And while Judah became the preeminent leader of the overall family, it was Joseph that received the birthright. And it was all because of that serious error in judgment, that serious moral failure on the part of Reuben earlier in life. Now, if you look at the encampment of Israel, some of this is interesting, and it demonstrates exactly what Jacob was talking about 400 years earlier before he died. When you look at the way, and God came up with this, Moses didn't come up with this. God prescribed where these people were supposed to camp when they were encamped. And so the tabernacle's in the center with the Levites, but on the east side, the favored side, the side toward the rising sun, you have Judah. And then beside him is Issachar and Zebulun, and all those fighting men report through Judah. So you have the fighting force of Judah on the east side. Then on the south side you have Reuben. He's the oldest son, but he's on the south side with Simeon and Gad. Now, what is significant about this is that when God said, when you pick up and you get ready to move, when I tell you to move camp, you pick up and pack up your camp. And when you get into marching formation, Judah and Issachar and Zebulun, those to the east, are in the very front. Judah's out there leading the people of God. And this is at Mount Sinai. This is not some promise, some messianic prophecy to David. That was a continuation of this. Jacob said, the scepter will never leave Judah. And he's starting right here at Mount Sinai. And we have Judah leading everyone out. Now, falling in behind them in marching order is Reuben, Simeon, and Gad to the south. Then you move around to the west, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. But in the middle there, in between the two groups, are the Levites with all the components to the tabernacle and so forth. They're well protected right in the middle. Then you have Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin, and bringing up the rear is Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. Now, that is significant. You've got Jude leading the way, Judah leading the way instead of Reuben. He has taken the preeminence at the very time that God gave the Israelites the law of Moses in Mount Sinai. Now, you look at that chart, you don't see Joseph. Well, what in the world's going on? Joseph get left out? No, you've got Ephraim and Manasseh on the west side. That is the two sons of Joseph, and they got their own tribes at the same level of standing as all of the other tribes. And so Joseph got his double portion that his father had predicted and prophesied 400 years earlier. Now, when they came, you recall they went from Mount Sinai, went up to Kadesh Barnea, wherever, and they sent some spies in. The people had no faith, and they sided with the faithless 10 spies. They had to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Now they're ready to go into the land, and Moses is still alive. And they go to the west side of the Jordan. They defeat a couple of kings over there, and that opens up Gilead. It opens up that region just north of Moab, just east of the Dead Sea and further up. And so they own this. They control this land now, and they want to settle there. Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh want to settle there. Moses is concerned. You're just going to leave your other brethren hanging as they go over here to fight these battles and conquer the land. They agreed, Reuben and Gad and Manasseh agreed to go over and fight with their brothers until they had conquered the land. They would get that resolved before they came back and settled with their families, and that pleased Moses, and they were allowed to do that. And so we find the descendants of Reuben settling just north of Moab, just east of the Dead Sea. That's their land. And of course, over the years, as you study through it, those borders tend to fluctuate depending on how faithful the people of God are. But that's where they began. Now, when you look at Moses' blessing, we talked about Jacob's blessing. You can learn a little bit about Reuben and his descendants by looking at Moses. By the time Moses is about to die, he's pronouncing blessings. Reuben's no longer there. Now it's the children of Reuben. It's a tribe of Reuben. And Moses said over in Deuteronomy 33, verse 6, may Reuben live and not die, nor his men be few. Now you think, well, that sounds nice. But when you look at some of the other blessings, it's pretty vanilla, okay? I mean, it's pretty lackluster for the number one son in the family. When you look at the lengthy verses devoted to Joseph and to Levi and some others, it's not very impressive. And I think it reflects the pronouncements of Jacob 450 years earlier. Now, what do we know about his tribe? And we'll go through this very quickly. Back when there was a man by the name of Korah, who happened to be a Levite, he rose up with some other men and decided that he didn't like the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Why are they better than we are? And he led a rebellion. Of course, God put that down and destroyed the men who were involved in it. But unfortunately, some of the sons of Reuben participated with Korah in that rebellion. And of course, they were punished for it. There's another event that we're told about in the scriptures that affected Reuben. You know, we said that Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh settled on the east side of the Jordan River. And the others went over and conquered the land, and they were apportioned land on the west side of the Jordan. Well, the Reubenites and the Gadites and half of the tribe of Manasseh built a massive altar close to the Jordan. And the first conclusion the people on the west side came to was they built another altar other than the altar of God, and they're gonna offer burnt offerings, and it's gonna make God angry, and we'll be back into Achan's situation all over again. We're gonna pay the price for their unfaithfulness, and it almost turned into a civil war until the Reubenites and the Gadites explained to them that's not an altar at all, it's a monument. To remind our children, remind your children, that just because the Jordan River's here, we're all one people, we're dedicated to Jehovah God just like you are. And so they averted a civil war over that. When Deborah and Barak fought against the king of Canaan and defeated him, using mostly soldiers from Zebulun and Naphtali up in the north, she sang that wonderful song, praising God and celebrating their victory. But in that song, she seems to scold Reuben and some of the others over on the east side of the Jordan for remaining in Gilead across the Jordan. She said, sitting among the sheepfolds to hear the piping of the flocks. Apparently, she wasn't real pleased with the amount of support they got from the Reubenites and others on the east side during that battle. But overall, you know, we don't hear a lot of bad things about the Reubenites. I think there's one lesson before we jump to Simeon and Levi. There's one lesson I think you need to think about, and that is, you know, the past sin can have some dire consequences. And you look around, you will see that every day. Whether it's people ruining their health with their past lifestyles, and now they've straightened up and they're Christian, but they're still suffering some health effects from the bad decisions they make. Somebody gets drunk one time, gets behind the wheel, and kills a family of four. Now he's in prison. God can forgive me, and he can forgive you of any sin. There's no sin that's too bad for God to forgive. But that doesn't mean he's going to take away the temporal consequences of what you've done. And we can bring serious consequences on ourselves and on those around us. And we see that in the life of Reuben. You know, say, well, one mistake. I mean, people commit immorality and it's a bad thing, but they get forgiven. But, you know, he never got over the consequences of that. And that can happen in our lives. And I always hate it, you know, when preachers just talk to just young people, because sin and temptation applies to all of us. But I will tell you, when you're starting out 15, 16, 18, 20, 22 years old, you're making decisions and you think you're invincible. I was there. I remember. But some of those decisions will come back and bite you. Over in Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 15 and 16. The King James Version says we need to walk circumspectly. I always love that word, circumspectly, but it's kind of obsolete. Therefore, be careful how you walk, the New American Standard says. Be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. God can forgive you of anything, but you can commit sins that have long-reaching effects that you just have to deal with for the rest of your life. And God's not going to take that away from you. It's just your cross to bear. We need to be careful about the decisions that we make. Simeon and Levi, I'm going to lump these two fellows together because they're lumped together in the narrative. Often, there were sons number 2 and 3, both of them sons of Leah. Simeon meant herd. H-E-A-R-D, heard, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved. He has therefore given me this son also. How sad is that? And then Levi meant joined to. Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him 3 sons. This competition just never lets up. And her sense of inadequacy and her her lack of being unloved compared to her little sister. Just she never got over it. And you see that even in the names that she gave her sons. There were six full brothers because they had the same mother, Leah. And so these two, Simeon and Levi, are full brothers with Reuben, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Okay. And of course, both of these fellows shared in the jealousy that all of the 11 brothers had toward Joseph, and they participated in that whole escapade in the life of Joseph. Again, just like Reuben, here are two men who became defined by some bad decisions that they made, and in particular toward the town of Shechem. It's a little confusing. There was a young man by the name of Shechem, and he was from the city of Shechem. So you get the feeling this family exerted a lot of influence in this town. And this young man forced himself on the youngest sister of Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. You know, those six boys had a little sister. Her name was Dinah. And this young man Shechem forced himself on her. But then he thought better of it later. He felt bad about it. He actually loved the girl. He wanted to marry her. They wanted the two families to get along and to have an accord with one another and so forth. Not justifying what he did, but he wanted to make things right. His heart was in the right place. And so Simeon and Levi took advantage of that. They were livid that this young man had done what he did. And so they said, well, we can't fellowship your family. We can't fellowship the men of Shechem unless all of you are circumcised. And they agreed to do it. That shows you the regard that this family was held in this town. All the men of the town were willing to do that for the good and the betterment of Shechem and for this relationship they could establish with Jacob and his family. And while they're recovering from their surgery, these two boys go in and destroy every male in the city of Shechem. Because they're so incensed about what happened to their little sister. And Jacob told them when it happened, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. That's what you've done. That's the consequences of your actions. In fact, they ended up having to pick up and leave and move the whole family down to Bethel and get away from Shechem because of what these boys had done. And you know what their response was? Should he treat our sister like a harlot? They never got over it. They were still trying to justify their actions. And I'll tell you, they were vicious men. I don't know what I'd do if somebody abused one of my family members. But I hope I wouldn't go out and slaughter a whole town of people. They were vicious men. Because they just couldn't get over it personally, emotionally, with the baggage that came along with what had been done to their sister. They were vicious. They were unjust. We're not talking about them catching Shechem out someplace and punishing him in some way. They destroyed an entire town of men to try to get back at Shechem. There was no justice involved in that whatsoever. And did it under pretense of friendship. They were unwise. I mean, look at what Jacob's saying. This isn't even smart. It's not only immoral to murder a bunch of men that did nothing wrong. Look at the end result. We can't even live here anymore. It's not even a smart thing to do. We can't defend ourselves against all the people that have been upset by this. We've got to pick up and move someplace where maybe they haven't heard so much about what you've done up here. They were unforgiving men. And I'll tell you, I know when people do horrible things to other people's families. And then you see somebody in the media interviews them and they say, I forgive them. It's tough. But these men should have had a little more grace in their hearts, especially when this young man loved the girl, wanted to make it right, not justifying what he did. But it's not the same as some vicious old guy that raped a girl and was happy about it and bragging about it. They were just unforgiving young men. Now, when you get to Jacob's, and I put blessing in quotes, you know, toward the end of his life, some of these blessings were not blessings at all. He was displeased and so was God. He said, Simeon, this is over in Genesis 49. I think that was our scripture reading this morning. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men. And in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce. And their wrath, for it is cruel. Now notice what he says. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Jacob knows about the sin they've committed. He knows how horrible it is. He pronounces that. Where does this dispersion come in? What does Jacob have to do with anything after he dies? This is prophetic on God's part. And I'll tell you, you look at when these tribes got into Canaan, what happened? You look at the map. You read the account of them going in and Joshua saying, Judah, this, you got this from here, this city, and over here, and down here, and up here, and back to the Dead Sea, and that's your property. And when they got all that done, somebody said, that's huge. That's too big for one tribe. And they said, okay, Simeon, you go in there and get these cities. I mean, that's how off the cuff it looked in the narrative. And it was the plan of God. I'm just going to disperse you. You don't deserve to have property set aside for you. I'm giving you some cities, and you're sort of mixed into Judah. And there's some scholars, you read on through the Chronicles and so forth, some scholars believe that Simeon just sort of got blended in and mixed in and not even recognizable anymore. I will disperse you. Now, where about Levi? Where's Levi at? Well, they're not on the map. God said, I'm going to give you this city and this city and this city and this city and this one and this one and this one and this one. And they happen to be dispersed throughout all of Israel, partly because, and we'll talk about this, but these fellows were to provide some spiritual guidance and support and so forth, and that would make them accessible to people throughout Israel. There was purpose behind it, but they didn't receive their own territory. They were dispersed throughout the land, just like God said through his servant Jacob 400 years before. And it was because of the sin that these men committed in destroying a city of innocent men. Now, when you look at their encampment, you got Simeon over here next to Reuben. And as we said last week, you read through the narrative, you find out that there's almost a regiment of Reuben on the south side. And they count up the number of men each of those three tribes, Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, have. And then they total up all three of those numbers and they say, that's under Reuben. Reuben has the leadership of those forces on the south side. So this is the regiment of Reuben, but Simeon is just out in the middle somewhere. Okay? Now, we get to the blessings of Moses. We kind of did that with Reuben. Might as well do it with Simeon. Well, you look at verse 6, verse 7, 11, 12. This is over in Deuteronomy 33. Verse 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. And you get to the end and it switches subjects to no Simeon. He doesn't even mention Simeon. I don't know why. But certainly the cursing of Jacob may not have done him any good. Okay? Now let's focus on Levi just a little bit. This was the tribe of Moses and Aaron, Miriam. Mosaic priest came from the tribe of Levi by the command of God. All of the firstborn, God said, belong to me. All the firstborn of your flocks, everything. Every time one of your animals has a firstborn, it belongs to me. And that applies to you and your children too. But instead of you giving up each of your sons, the oldest sons from the families, I'll take the tribe of Levi. And the tribe of Levi will supplant for that your oldest sons and each of your families, the firstborn. And so the Levites belong to God in a special way. All the priests came from Levi. They were there to assist in the service that the priest offered. They took care of and maintained the tabernacle. They would pack it up as God prescribed and carry it. They were the ones who carried the Ark of the Covenant before the Lord. And so they were God's spiritual arm to the Israelite people, if you will. And again, here's that disconnect between the wickedness of the father and God using them in an honorable way. You noticed in their encampment, Levi didn't have their own camp. Well, they did. They were camped in and around the tabernacle in the middle, because that was their responsibility to serve and to carry those things and care for them. And so that's where they camped. They weren't out around the perimeter. When you look at their character real quickly, the Levites sided with Moses when he came down the mountain. Aaron had made this golden calf for him. They were all dancing. The Levites voluntarily sided with Moses in that. Korah was a Levite, so there were some Levites involved in that rebellion of Korah. But in general, the Levites tended to be more faithful to God than the average population among the people of God. There were exceptions to that. They all apostatized at times. But there were times when the Levites were more faithful than the others. Later in the divided kingdom, you will find the prophets criticizing the priest in particular for no longer providing the shepherdhood and the leadership, spiritual leadership that they should have provided for the people. And so there were criticisms as well. We're a little short of time. I'm going to skip over the blessings of Moses. We may talk about that some other time. That's over in Deuteronomy 33. It is good stuff, and we'll deal with that. Let's look at a lesson I think that we can learn from Simeon and Levi. And I think that lesson is that posterity of a person can forge their own relationship with God regardless of what daddy was like, what their ancestor was like. And you can see that illustrated throughout the history of the divided kingdom. Kings like Asa and Joash and Hezekiah and Josiah all had wicked fathers who reigned as kings in Judah, and they were horrible, despicable men. And yet Asa and Joash and Hezekiah, men like that, didn't use that as an excuse. They stepped up when God needed them. They dedicated themselves to Jehovah God. They got rid of idol worship. They tried to bring the people back to worshiping God exclusively. They didn't allow their forefathers to define who they were. The tribe of Levi enjoyed a place of honor among the Israelite people in their history, despite some of the mistakes that their father made before them. And the same is true for us. We can choose godliness. You can choose godliness this morning. Doesn't matter about your parents. Doesn't matter what kind of background you come from. And I realize not everybody is born equal. Not everybody's born on a level playing field. Some people have it easier than others economically. Some people have it easier than other people morally, and they're raised in despicable circumstances. Doesn't matter. God is looking to me, and he's looking to you and saying, here's my grace and mercy. Here's what I'm offering to you. And now the decision is yours. Don't look back to daddy. Forget daddy. Daddy doesn't matter. I'm concerned about you. I'm not concerned about your past life. You repent of those things. You leave them behind. You do what I tell you, and I'll forgive you. I'll remove those sins. I'll show you how to live. I'll show you the light. And you can live a glorious life by my precepts. It doesn't matter where your humble beginning started out. And if we don't learn any lesson from men like Simeon and Levi, we ought to learn that. And it certainly applies to us this morning. If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian, it doesn't matter what your background is. But God sent his son. Every one of us sinned against him. Every one of us separated us from the God who loves us by the sins that we committed. But he didn't leave us there. He sent his son to die on the cross for your sins and for my sins. And as long as you're willing to repent of those past sins, confess Jesus as Lord of your life, and that has implications, and then be baptized into Jesus Christ, to put on Christ, to establish a relationship with him, you can have every sin washed away. You can stand justified before God as if you've never committed any sins. And then you can study to understand what his will is, apply those principles to your life. And there is no better way to live in this life. And we can live with God eternally after this life is over, not because we turned out to be such wonderful people, but by his grace and mercy. And that's what he's offering you. But it's up to you. And none of us can point back and say, my daddy was so good, I ought to get a free ride. Or my daddy was so bad, look at the excuses I've got. Doesn't work that way. And I will stand before God alone. And you will stand before God alone. And he's going to say, what do you do with the opportunities I gave you? If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian, you need to be. And we can help you with that. If you're a Christian, there's sin in your life, get rid of that. God has made provision for you to repent of those things, confess them humbly to him, ask for his forgiveness, ask for his help, and he'll forgive you. And we're here to help. If there's something we can do to encourage you in some way, pray with you, we'd love to do that. But we need to know about it. Come forward if you're subject to the invitation, let us know while we stand together and sing.